Okay. I want to thank also the organizers for their kind invitation and considerable patience. For various reasons, I do not have slides. One reason is that I looked at my slides last night and decided I didn't like them, and it just seemed more sensible to get some sleep and do this freehand. But another reason is, you know, the more that I thought about it, it does seem a shame to waste all of this wonderful infrastructure. It's really a luxury. Where I work, the blackboards are fixed, and there are only three of them in front of me, and I have to make do with those. Okay, I'm going to try to do probably much too much, or to say much too much today, so I'd better get started. I'm going to start with some fairly general remarks to offer you both a point of view, which is probably not very different from one that you've heard expressed by a number of people at this meeting, and then also to point out what I take to be a little bit of a puzzle, or at least a certain tension between two observations that one can make if one takes that point of view. And then I'm going to try to suggest one way of resolving that tension, a way that leads us in the direction of the talk's title, and in particular in the direction of certain Jordan algebras. In order to do that, I'm going to need to explain more than a bit about the mathematical framework in which this work gets done. So that's part two. Part two is just a little miniature mathematical lecture, a capsule review of what's sometimes called the general probabilistic theories framework. But increasingly, I've come to think of it as something that we should really get used to as just thinking of as probability theory, with classical probability theory just as a special case. I'll say more about that in a moment. So then I'll talk about, a particular way of axiomatizing certain kinds of probabilistic models that then leads to representations of these models in terms of Jordan algebras. And then I'll close, if as I hope I have time for it, by talking about how one composes models of this sort, how one forms, in effect, tensor products of such models. Okay, so let me start with some general remarks. If I write down here at the level that's comfortable for me, can you guys still see down here at the bottom of the board? Okay, good. All right. So let me start with something that I just alluded to. It's you know, well known that at least in some sense, one can view quantum mechanics as some sort of a generalization of classical probability theory, or at least quantum mechanics comes equipped with an algorithm for computing certain probabilities, and to that extent, it comes equipped with a kind of probability calculus. And it's a very, very old idea, going at least back to von Neumann's work, and threading all the way through the work of Mackey, not perhaps all, but much of the literature on quantum logic, and the sort of parallel work of people like Ludwig and Mielnik and all of the people who wanted to reformulate quantum mechanics in terms of convex sets. It's this old, old idea that you in fact should regard quantum mechanics as a generalization of classical probability theory. So let's just illustrate this idea by saying that we have this perhaps sharply defined, well-understood theory. I'll write this as, classical probability theory. I'll just abbreviate it that way. And then there's this more general, perhaps not quite so well-understood theory that maybe we shouldn't call quite quantum mechanics, but at least we could call quantum probability theory. Thanks very much. It turns out to be helpful in a lot of different ways, at least to clarify various issues. Stop that. To take a step back and to regard both of these things as, in fact, just special cases of a more general theory still. Actually, one that's quite easy to understand. It's pretty straightforward, in fact. This is what's often called generalized probability theory. Maybe we could call it GPT, although, as I indicated a moment ago, I think in a way that extra adjective isn't really necessary. General probability theory, as I just said, is pretty straightforward. Classical probability theory, of course, is well studied and easy to motivate. Quantum probability theory seems less easy to motivate as a probability calculus. Now, in recent years, actually a lot of progress has been made in the direction of supplying that kind of motivation. We have, at this point, a lot of reconstructions or derivations of finite dimensional quantum mechanics from broadly information theoretic, or maybe you could even say probabilistic, postulates or axioms. Now, of course, this all starts with Lucian's work around 2000, and then more recent entries would include work of Dakic and Bruckner. I'll just write DB for them, and Sanis and Müller. Here, okay. They're both here. Are they both here? Okay, just Müller. Okay, and then also Ciribella and Dariano and Perinotti. And there are others as well, Jochen Rau and some others. But these last three in particular have actually managed to derive, following the lead of Lucian's paper, but maybe getting a slightly sharper result, they've managed to derive, or at least offered to derive, standard finite dimensional quantum mechanics on the nose from their various packages of axioms. And I guess that could be regarded as offering support for this general view that one should regard quantum mechanics, or at least its probabilistic content, as just a natural generalization of classical probability theory, constrained by a few reasonable regularity requirements so that it's not quite as wild as the general theory that would consider any conceivable probabilistic theory. So that's all well and good. On the other hand, there's something I find a little bit puzzling about this. And the thing I find a little puzzling about this is the very fact that these axioms get standard finite dimensional quantum mechanics on the nose. The reason that might be puzzling is that real quantum mechanics and quaternionic quantum mechanics, I'll write block H for the quaternions, are maybe at least in some sort of a priori sense, also plausible candidate quantum theories. Plausible enough, at least, that if one were already interested in the prospect of finding some sort of a generalization of ordinary quantum theory, these might be theories that one would look at. So it's at least striking that this axiomatic framework seems to just, you know, take these off the stage very decisively. One would like to know why. Well, if you look at the axiomatic frameworks in any of these papers, and actually in it was a kind of a key piece of Lucian's paper, there's one axiom that does the job, that wipes these away. And that axiom goes by several names. Howard and I like to call it, like to call it local tomography. And this is the doctrine that says that the state of a composite system is just determined by, is fixed by, the joint probabilities that that state assigns to measurement outcomes on the component systems. Now that's a property that composites of complex quantum mechanical systems enjoy, that composites of real quantum mechanical systems don't. And it's well known that they don't. It's been pointed out sort of over and over throughout the years that this is a feature of real quantum mechanics that makes it look rather different from complex quantum mechanics. When one is dealing with quaternionic quantum systems, there are questions one has to address about what one even means by a composite system, but with a little care, one can convince oneself that it's reasonable to form composites of quaternionic quantum mechanical systems. In fact, when you do, you get real quantum mechanical systems. There again, local tomography fails. So local tomography just rules those out. Yes?
Just want to clarify it, because I must be misunderstanding something. On standard quantum mechanics, we're used to entangled states like EPR states violating something that sounds like that.
Okay, so, then it's my fault for making it sound like that.
Well, no, or it's my fault for misunderstanding.
All right, well, fine.
It's the case, take two electrons in an entangled EPR state. It's the case that the state with a plus and minus phase relation, right, both of those states have identical sets of probabilities for the outcomes of any experiments on particle one, particle two,
The marginals are the same. The marginals are not.
Good.
Okay, so if we are in fact looking for...
Go
ahead.
Just another clarificatory question. When you say it's determined by the joint probability, do you mean, and that's all it is,
Well, what I mean by that is that if you have two states that make the same joint probability assignments, they are in fact the same state.
That's all you mean.
And that's all I mean.
That's it.
That's the content of that state. So if we're interested in building a theory that goes a little beyond quantum mechanics, and if we're entertaining the idea that maybe it should be friendly to real and quaternionic quantum mechanics, then local tomography would seem to be one axiom that one could at least consider weakening or maybe even omitting. Now, there's another axiom, which I'm not going to try to summarize in chalk, I'll just mention, that that shows up either directly or in some formulation, maybe disguised a little bit in I think maybe all of these papers, but certainly in most of them, which you could call a uniformity assumption. It's the assumption that if you have two physical systems that have, in some sense, the same information-carrying capacity, a concept you can formalize in various ways, that they should be equivalent. They should be structurally the same. Possibly one would restrict that to elementary systems. So let's talk about maybe bits, systems in which there are only two possible outcomes for each experiment. if that uniformity axiom were satisfied, then while that wouldn't rule out real quantum mechanics and it wouldn't rule out quaternionic quantum mechanics, it would certainly rule out any sort of theory that allowed both on an equal footing, because then you would get bits of two different dimensions and that wouldn't be allowed. So that's another axiom that one could perhaps think about weakening, since it seems by fiat to rule out a possibility one might want to consider that doesn't seem, at least doesn't seem to me, outrageously implausible. Okay, let me talk just very briefly about how one, I'll never get it down. All right. I just need a helper who's very tall.
Hockey
stick. I know, but actually I've tried this before and it's surprisingly hard. There we go. And you see it wants to go back up. I have to get it down to a certain point or it will. Oh well, let's let it stay there for now. Let's talk just a little bit about real and quaternionic quantum mechanics. There's a lovely recent paper that I'm sure many of you have seen. I do want chalk. Wayne assured me there was a mountain of chalk in many colors, and yet I'm down to two stubs. It's floated up to the ceiling. Okay. No, all right. Thank you. So, while Howard rescues the chalk, thank you. This is a mountain. You call this a mountain?
There's some.
All right. Well, I'll talk until the chalk runs out. Let's see. So, let's talk a little bit about real and quaternionic quantum mechanics. So there's this lovely paper of Baez on the quaternions and octonions, I guess, in which he makes what I think is a pretty compelling case that maybe one should regard real and quaternionic quantum theory as especially taken together as a reasonable formulation of some physics. At any rate, he reprises very nicely something that's been known, I think, folklorically for quite a long time, and it's that one can regard a real Hilbert space let's say H, and I'll put a little R there to remind us that it's real. One can regard such a thing, or represent such a thing, as a pair consisting of a complex Hilbert space and an anti-unitary operator J. With J squared equaling minus the identity operator. It's called an anti-unitary involution. If you start with a real Hilbert space and you complexify it, you form its direct sum with another copy of itself, which you think of as I times the first copy, then this is simply complex conjugation, vector complex conjugation. Conversely, if you're given this anti-unitary that squares to, plus the identity, okay. If you're given that, then if you look at the fixed points of J, then that's a real subspace of HC, of the complex space, and the complex space is the complexification of that space up to a completely natural isomorphism. In a similar way, if you've got a quaternionic Hilbert space, let's call it, allow the barbaric notation. I don't even know how to read that aloud. Okay, so there. If we have that, that can be represented as a pair consisting of a complex Hilbert space and an anti-unitary operator J. This time with J squared, in fact, equaling minus the identity. And the idea here is that J works rather like the quaternionic unit little j. You have already little I because HC is complex. You've got this anti-unitary j that squares to negative 1. And so if you simply define, let's call it k to be the scalar I times this anti-unitary, well, now you have three things that behave just like the three quaternionic units. And you can use those to extend the scalar field. You can let the ring of operators generated by those act on H sub C, and in fact it generates the quaternions, so you get a quaternionic space. Okay, so far so good. Once you decide to represent real and quaternionic Hilbert spaces in this way, you can ask, how should I compose them? And there's, in some sense, an easy way to do it. Let me drop the subscript block C. My spaces now are complex. If I have a complex Hilbert space H1 and unitary J and J1 rather, and a complex Hilbert space 2 and an anti-unitary J2, where J1 squared and J2 squared are both either plus or minus 1, then define their tensor product to be the ordinary tensor product of H1 and H2, and look at the anti-unitary J1 tensor J2. The thing that you discover if you decide to do this is that if J1 and J2 both squared and negative the identity, then J1 tensor J2 squares 2 plus the identity, and so the tensor product of two quaternionic Hilbert spaces is a real Hilbert space. Seems perfectly natural. Now, Baez makes a remark somewhere in here, one that I'm not qualified to evaluate at all, but I'll still quote it because paraphrase it because it seems interesting and perhaps provocative. He says, look, this is basically the same multiplication rule that you have when you try to combine bosons and fermions. And perhaps with better reason than that, though again, I don't advertise myself as understanding this very well. He says, yeah, in fact, it's reasonable to regard real Hilbert spaces as simply a setting in which to talk about, you will help me out here, see if I get this right, in which to talk about bosons and the quaternionic ones as a framework in which to talk about quaternions, and then you can form tensor products of these things and combine your bosons and fermions in just the familiar way. All right. So, at least to that extent, it seems like there may be something of interest going on with real and quaternionic quantum mechanics, in spite of the fact that they're not locally tomographic. So, what happens if we give up on local tomography? Well, I don't know what happens to the specific axiomatic frameworks listed up there. I haven't looked at it, though I think some of the authors may have. But I will show you in a moment an axiomatic system, one that I think has a lot to recommend it in terms of simplicity, that leads to a classification of at least finite dimensional systems as direct sums of real or complex or real or complex or quaternionic quantum mechanical systems, possibly an additional kind of system called a spin factor, and possibly, if you're disposed to let it into the club, something called the exceptional Jordan algebra. And many of you already know where this is going. I've just more or less summarized the Jordan von Neumann-Wigner classification of Euclidean or formerly real Jordan algebras. Before I rehearse that in any more detail, I'd like to talk a little bit about probability theory. I need to start making a lot of the things that I've been saying more precise. So let me start over here. And ask this question. If we are interested in maybe not even physics per se, but just probability theory, a natural place to start is where you would start if you were teaching, I don't know, high school statistics. If you have an experiment, it has a set of outcomes, which I'll call capital E, just generically. And for the time being, in fact, indeed for this entire talk, let's suppose that we're doing discrete, indeed finitary probability theory. You have a finite set of outcomes. You're also interested in probability weights. That is, functions that assign real numbers to the outcomes in E. They're non-negative, and they add up to 1 over the set E. Right? And that's, in some sense, what discrete, or indeed finitary, classical probability theory is all about, that and other structures that you build on that basis. Okay, that's fair enough. What if you have not just a single experiment that you're interested in, but you have two? Maybe you're not just rolling a die or flipping a coin. Maybe you have a choice. You can pick the die or the coin. Maybe there are many, many experiments that you have available. Maybe they're parameterized by, conceivably by continuous parameters that might reflect things like knob settings and the like. It might be a very complicated thing. Classical probability theory makes, mostly tacitly, a very strong assumption. Which is that all experiments are compatible. Now, one can be much more precise mathematically about what that means, but I think in the interest of time, I won't be. The basic idea is if you have two different experiments, you can always find a third experiment and a representation of each of the experiments you started with as coarse grainings of that third experiment. That's a strong assumption, and it's a contingent assumption. It's by no means obvious that the world needs to be like that. Certainly, it's not obvious from any kind of a Bayesian point of view about what probabilities are. So let's just get rid of it. If you drop that assumption, what you have, this is awkward because what I mean is that the deletion of that axiom seems to imply, or lead us to, a generalized probability theory. And the generalized probability theory that I have in mind considers things that I'm going to call probabilistic models. So let me tell you what those look like. A probabilistic model, I'll just call it A generically, is a triple, big X, big M, and big omega. Big X is a set of outcomes, an outcome space. It's irrelevant for my purposes to what kinds of objects these outcomes are. They're the kinds of things you want to regard as outcomes of experiments and to which you want to assign probabilities. Take your pick. Big M is a set of measurements, experiments, what have you. It's formally a collection of subsets of big X that covers big X. It's a covering of X by outcome sets of possible measurements. So big M, in fact, is your space of possible measurements if we identify each measurement with its outcome set. Finally, omega is a set of probability weights on the structure big X, this is going fast, this chart, big M. What that means is it's a set of functions from big X to the reals. It's going to assign to every possible outcome of every possible experiment some real number, which will be its probability. So that means that I want the probability of outcome little x to be non-negative. And I want these probabilities to add up correctly to 1 over every experiment or measurement in the set script M. Now, this seems to me like a pretty bare bones notion of what a probabilistic model should look like. We might impose a few additional regularity requirements. One is that we might want to let omega, the set of probability weights, be convex, be closed under convex combinations, be closed under the formation of statistical mixtures, if we think we can randomize the preparation of states, or if we think it makes sense to talk about a situation in which we are unsure which state we're in, but we have some sort of an a priori probability or prior on these weights, then convexity seems natural. I'm also going to assume in what follows that omega is closed. Well, everything in omega is a function from X to R, so big omega is a subset of the function space R to the X, which is just a big Cartesian product, and I want it to be pointwise closed, and therefore it's going to be compact, since actually it's contained in the unit interval to the X. Yes, Joe.
So what are the conditions on this covering? What exactly?
It's a covering. But, well, I guess I should say that the outcome sets are not empty. There are no other conditions. In particular, I'm glad you asked the question because there's an important point. At this very preliminary stage, I don't want to impose any kind of combinatorial conditions on big M. I don't want to impose any restrictions of any kind. We'll put conditions on later. But a priori, it's hard for me to see that any reason why you couldn't have fairly arbitrary structures of this sort showing up as legitimate models of some sort of chance situation, maybe not in physics, but in some domain.
So maybe
you tell me what the covering is.
Yeah, sure. It basically just means that if I union up all of the sets in big M, big M, I get X. So here, picture. Here's the outcome space, right? These little dots are individual outcomes, things that can happen.
Those are the X's?
This is big X, yeah. And these are little X's. Now, if I've got several different experiments I can make, well, I should be able to talk about maybe these being the possible outcomes of experiment E, and maybe these are the possible outcomes of experiment F, and so on. And so when I say it's a covering, I mean every outcome gets to be an outcome because it's the outcome of some experiment you can do. Right.
Is there a notion of preparation?
No,
here?
At this point there isn't.
So what do the probabilities mean? These alphas, are they alphas for what? Not for given preparations?
Well, I mean, we don't talk about preparations when we do very elementary probability theory, typically.
Okay.
We say, here's a die, and you know, maybe we can figure out what the probability is by rolling the die many times, or maybe we have some sort of prior that we want to put on it. I want to be completely neutral about those questions at this point. Not just completely neutral, but sort of methodologically naive, if you like. Okay? I want this to be as simple as possible. And as flexible when it comes to interpretation as possible. So minimum of structure. All right, now, it's kind of astonishing that you can do anything at all with a structure this loose, but one thing you can do is you can take any probabilistic model and from it you can construct two vector spaces. In fact, they're not just arbitrary vector spaces, they are ordered vector spaces. So I need to pause and ask a question here. How many people do not know what an ordered vector space is? You can't be shy, I need to know. As I tell my students, if you don't raise your hand, I assume you know. Okay, but David has raised his hand and that's enough. So, and other people as well. So what's an ordered vector space? Quick tutorial. An ordered vector space is a vector space, I'll write it that way. It's a real vector space, together with, equipped with, endowed with a cone, which I'll call big V plus. Okay, so what's a cone? A cone is a subset of the vector space. It is convex. It's closed under multiplication by non-negative scalars. So if X is in V plus, that implies TX is in V plus, as long as scalar T is greater than or equal to 0. And there are some other conditions as well, one of which is that V plus intersect minus V plus. Minus V plus is the set of negatives of vectors in V plus is 0. And another is that the span of V plus is all of V, which, if you think about it for a few minutes, you can convince yourself amounts to saying that everything in V is the difference of two things in V plus. Now, why do we call a vector space equipped with a convex cone with these properties ordered? Well, the reason is that if I have such a convex cone, I can define a partial ordering on the vectors in V by setting x less than or equal to y if and only if y minus x is in V plus. In other words, V plus is our abstract notion of the set of vectors that are positive, non-negative, I guess I better should say. The ordering has some nice properties. It plays nicely with the linear structure. And conversely, if you have a linear order, an ordering that plays nicely in relevant ways with the linear ordering, you can show that this set is a cone that in turn induces the order. So that's an ordered vector space. That's at least what it is abstractly. David, at this point, do you know what an ordered vector space is?
Yes, yeah.
No, you should say no. I want to see an example. Okay. So of course you'd like to see an example. So let me show you a quick example.
So is this actually like a partial order? Because
yes, it's a partial order. These are very rarely linearly ordered, as you'll see in a moment. So let me show you three examples. Take any set, X maybe, and is everybody comfortable with this notation? I've used it once already. It's the set of functions from X to R as a vector space. You add things pointwise, scalar multiply pointwise. Well, this is ordered by a very natural cone. The cone consists of the functions f, let's say, that are non-negative on the points of big X. That's an ordered vector space, one that you work with all the time. Okay, here's another example. Let's say script H is a Hilbert space. And actually what I'm about to say works for real and quaternionic Hilbert spaces, but let's say for the moment that it's the usual kind over C. I'll write script L sub H of sub little h, of big H. Once again, the notation is easier to read than to say, for the set of Hermitian operators on H. Oh, you know, I've neglected to say something that's very important. And actually, I'm sorry, I don't know your name.
John,
but I want to take it in vain. John corrected me a moment ago when I was putting the title up there by pointing out that I had not put finite dimensional in my title, although it's in the abstract. And it's very important that it be there. So let me emphasize this here. For the entire duration of this talk, all that's to come and all that has gone before, all vector spaces are finite dimensional, okay? And so for that to be true, X should be a finite set or something like that. So I'm not being completely consistent, but you'll survive. Okay, so this is going to be the set of all self-adjoint, or if you like, Hermitian operators on H. I guess I can say it like this, instead of all operators on H that are self-adjoint. There we go. Now, that's a vector space. That's a real vector space. What's its cone? Well, you already know what its cone is. Its cone is the set of all positive semi-definite operators, the set of all operators that are greater than or equal to the zero operator in the usual operator theoretic ordering. So that's the place where all the density operators live. It's the place where all the projections live. Right? It's again an ordered vector space that we use all the time. So those are two examples. Here's a third example. Take Rn. Maybe n is 2 and it's the blackboard, or anything else you like, R3. And take some nice compact convex set. And this is meant to be a perspective drawing. You're looking into the board. And situate the origins somewhere, let's say, below that set, and then look at the set of rays through that convex set, and those rays taken together, all the vectors along all of those rays, form a cone that gives you an ordered vector space. So you can develop an ordered vector space in that way from any compact convex set. Okay, so this was a little bit of a digression, though a necessary one. I was about to tell you that any probabilistic model gives you a pair of ordered vector spaces. And so here we go. Suppose A is a probabilistic model. outcome set X, space of measurements or experiments, big M, and space of, I guess we could call them states, distinguished probability weights, omega. I'm going to let big V of A, the space V associated with the model, be the span of omega in R to the X. Every state is a vector in the function space R to the X. And in fact, you could even abstractly say it kind of looks like this, where we replace R to the N by R to the X. You have this convex set omega, indeed closed, therefore compact convex set omega. And I want the cone to consist, just as in that picture, of all non-negative multiples of states. All right, so it's one ordered vector space that comes for free when I have the convex set of states associated with the model. Now, I'm going to give you another ordered vector space. For every outcome little x in big X, there's a corresponding linear functional, which I'm going to call x hat, in the dual of V of A. Is that okay if I write an asterisk there for the dual space of that vector space? Okay, there's a linear functional there. It's just given by evaluation, right? X hat of alpha is alpha of X. I'm going to let big E, block E, not lowercase, not just ordinary capital E, but block E of A, be the span of these functionals in V of A star. And I'm going to let the positive cone of this thing consist of all linear combinations of these evaluation functions, finite linear combinations of these evaluation functions, where the coefficients are non-negative. So now I have two ordered vector spaces. There is a natural way of putting an ordering, or if you like, defining a cone, for the dual of an ordered vector space. This is contained in that dual cone, but it's seldom equal to it. In fact, the space V of A, its dual space with its natural dual cone, what is the natural dual cone? It's a set of linear functionals that are non-negative on elements of V's cone. That cone, and then this cone that I just defined here, E of A plus. They're all, in general, quite different. However, in both classical and quantum cases, they're all the same. Let me see if I can summarize that quickly. The good thing about a chalk talk is that it slows you down so that everybody can follow you very well. The bad thing about a chalk talk is that it slows you down, so you usually get through about half what you'd meant to. So I'm going to have to speed up a little bit if I'm going to get it to some kind of a punchline. Okay, so what's the classical case of all of this? In the classical case, your model would look like this. There would only be one outcome set. There would only be one experiment, block E. Script M would consist of, well, that experiment. And then your set of probability weights would presumably be all probability weights, the simplex delta E of all probability weights. And if you take that as your model, what do you get when you perform this construction here? Well, you find that V of A is just R to the E, and you find that block E of A is, in a natural way, isomorphic to, as an ordered vector space, same cone, in fact, to V of A star, which is to say the dual of this finite function space, which is isomorphic using just the usual inner product on this space to the space itself. So in particular, these three are all the same. In the quantum case, you have the same phenomenon, although it's a much deeper fact. In the quantum case, the model that you start with consists of the unit sphere of a Hilbert space H. I'll write X of H for that unit sphere. Script M of H is going to be the set of orthonormal bases. For H. And what's omega? Well, omega of H is going to be essentially the set of density operators. Well, it's a set of the set of probability weights associated with density operators, things that look like alpha of X is inner product WX, X, where W is a density operator. Just the usual quantum mechanical states regarded as probability assignments on unit vectors. If you start with that model and you go through this construction, you find that V of A is isomorphic as an ordered vector space, not just as a vector space, but the cones are isomorphic, to the Hermitian operators on H, which in turn is isomorphic to big E of A. So all of these things, all of these things are the same. That phenomenon in the general theory of ordered vector spaces is known as self-duality. So let me talk about self-duality briefly and then show you how this all ties together. Try to. An ordered vector space, let's call it E, thinking of the block E over here. So it's an ordered real vector space is self-dual if and only if there exists an inner product, which I'll just call angle brackets as usual, inner product on block E such that the set E superscript plus consisting of all the vectors A in E whose inner product with every vector X in E's positive cone is positive, a kind of an internal representation of the dual space, the dual cone of big E, if and only if that is equal to E plus. In other words, the given inner product makes E self dual if and only if a vector is positive, if and only if it has a positive inner product with every other positive vector. That's self dual. Now, what's special about self-dual vector spaces? Well, first of all, there aren't that many of them. It's almost but not quite true that self-duality is kind of characterizes these two kinds of examples. Not quite, but it comes pretty close, surprisingly close. There's another property I do need to invoke. We say that the ordered vector space E is homogeneous if and only if, for every pair of vectors A and B in the positive cone of E, but the interior of that cone, that's probably a bad notation. I'll write int there. So they're not on the boundary of the cone, but strictly inside of it. There exists an isomorphism of ordered vector spaces from E to itself, an automorphism of E, call it phi. Taking one to the other. In other words, if and only if the group of automorphisms of the ordered vector space acts transitively on the interior of the cone. There's a remarkable theorem, at this point a classical theorem, proved in the early 60s, or maybe even late 50s and early 60s.
Koshin was first, maybe
58 and then 60 or 61 for Vinberg. It's called the Kosher-Vinberg theorem, or Coker-Vinberg theorem. And it says this. If you have an ordered vector space E that is homogeneous and self-dual, then there exists a Jordan product on E. Now that just means a commutative bilinear product that satisfies the Jordan identity. turning E into a Jordan algebra. In fact, it does a little more than that. There is a Jordan product on E satisfying the condition that for all vectors in big E, A Jordan product B comma C, the inner product of A dot B with C is B comma A dot C like that. There is a Jordan product that interacts nicely with that inner product, with respect to which the positive cone you started with is the set of Jordan squares of elements of E. In other words, the only ordered finite dimensional ordered vector spaces that have homogeneous self-dual cones are what are called Euclidean Jordan algebras. This condition here makes the Jordan algebra Euclidean. Euclideanness is the same, basically, as formal reality. So these are the same things as formally real Jordan algebras. And that's a great thing, because there's an even more classical result, the classification theorem I mentioned earlier, due to Jordan, von Neumann, and Wigner. Which tells us something about Euclidean Jordan algebras. They're all direct sums of real or complex or quantum systems, or the ordered vector spaces associated with them, together with possibly the exceptional Jordan algebra and possibly what are called spin factors. So all are direct sums of real, complex, and quaternionic quantum systems, quantum probabilistic models, if you like, or the exceptional Jordan algebra E8, or things called spin factors. What are spin factors? Since time is almost up, I'll be very brief. Spin factors are the Jordan algebras whose ordered vector spaces look like the first picture I drew, but where the base of the cone here is a sphere of any dimension you like. So actually, in low enough dimensions, these are quantum systems, but then the dimension can be arbitrary. So if you can motivate homogeneity and self-duality, if you can write down conditions on a probabilistic model that will guarantee homogeneity and self-duality, then you can invoke these classical results, and you find that you are at least in the ballpark of a theory that would seem to be ready to unify real, complex, and quaternionic quantum mechanics. The more so if you note that there is a way of composing Euclidean Jordan algebras, which I'll just describe very briefly. And then I'm going to make an apology for having skipped the axiomatics, because I just don't have time. But if you're curious about that, please ask me. There are some interesting, easy axioms that will, in fact, do this. In fact, I'll write this on the board. So a few, I guess I'll call them simple axioms about conjugates and correlations. Imply that the vector spaces associated with a probabilistic model are in fact homogeneous and self-dual, and therefore give you these Jordan algebras. Okay, how do you compose Jordan algebras? Well, you can't do it locally tomographically, because we know that that would rule out the very real and quaternionic cases that we want to deal with. So there must be another way to do it. Fortunately, there is. There's a tensor product for Euclidean Jordan algebras, actually due originally to a Norwegian mathematician, still living, by the name of Harald Hansje Olsen. And the way this works essentially is to say, I have to be a little careful here. It's a tensor product for special Euclidean Jordan algebras. Special means that you basically go through here and you, by fiat, say, that's too ugly, throw it away. There are perhaps other things you can say, like, we don't believe that that actually can have a tensor product of any meaningful sort with itself, even. So you get rid of that, all of the others. All of the others can be embedded in the Hermitian parts of complex matrix algebras. In fact, in a universal way. If you have a special Euclidean Jordan algebra, it sits in a canonical way inside a special C star algebra, finite dimensional one, it's really just a complex matrix algebra called C star of E. What Hansje Olsen does is to take for two of these guys, say E1 and E2, the tensor product of those two matrix algebras. And then he looks at the Jordan subalgebra of that generated by pure tensors of things in here and things in here. And closing up on, under the Jordan product, he gets something that he calls E1 tensor twiddle E2. That has some nice universal properties. And it has another lovely property. And that lovely property is that if you apply that construction to the vector spaces that arise from the quantum probabilistic models associated with real or quaternionic quantum systems, it turns out you get the right thing. You get the thing I described way back at the beginning. So where does this leave us? It leaves us with something that looks like at least a somewhat coherent probabilistic theory in which all three kinds of quantum mechanics coexist, in which at least real and quaternionic quantum systems compose in the right way, and in which you have a little more elbow room than you had before because you have the spin factors, which can also be tensored with each other and with quantum systems, and interesting things happen. But I think I'm going to have to stop there. And so apologies for skipping the part of my talk that the title alludes to, or at least the first half of it.